Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is journalist, writer, correspondent, Charles C. Mann. And we're talking about his new book, The Wizard and the Prophet, Two Remarkable Scientists and Their Dueling Visions to Shape Tomorrow's World. Charles, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be on with you.
Now, this is a fascinating book because it's partly a biography of two people. Talk to me about who they are.
Well, one of them is Norman Borlaug, and he is the main figure in what's been called the Green Revolution, which is the combination of high-yielding seeds, high-intensity fertilizer, and irrigation that doubled, tripled, or even quadrupled grain yields pretty much around the world, and with the result that huge numbers of people in the 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, and right on to the present were saved from famine. It's the basic reason that the world has been able to feed itself. The other person is a guy named William Vogt, and he's the progenitor of the modern environmental movement. He's the guy who put the basic ideas together. The basic idea is that there's these ecological processes that we transgress at our peril. There's these limits, and he called it carrying capacity. Other terms are like ecological limits or planetary boundaries. But the basic idea is, you know, put on your cardigan sweater and turn down the thermostat and eat lower on the food chain and all that sort of stuff. And he was the guy who put together these ideas, which have been tremendously powerful and have just gotten more powerful ever since he put them together. And kind of an interesting thing is they both got their ideas at the same time in the same place.
That's right.
If you think about it, they're actually quite opposite in their implications.
Well, you describe them as two ends of a continuum.
Right.
And explain what that would be.
Well, Borlaug has become the emblem of the idea that science and technology, properly applied, will let us produce our way out of our dilemmas. You know, are we going to have more people? Do we have more food? Let's put on our thinking caps and turn on the science machine, and we'll produce more food. We need more water, more energy. We fight climate change. Science and technology is the way to go. We'll make more of whatever it is. Vogt is very much the opposite, and he says, "Hey, look. We make more. That's the problem. We're making too much, and we need to conserve. We need to cut back. Otherwise, everybody's going to lose, as opposed to make more so everybody can win." And these two guys met just once, and they immediately detested each other. And
I totally understand that. Okay.
Yeah. Attempted to, in a sort of half-hearted way to get Borlaug shut down. Didn't work. And thereafter, they refuse to pretty much deal with each other. And as a result, this kind of debate, which goes underneath a whole lot of the discussions about, how we're going to deal with the challenges of the future, has really never been engaged. And my book was partly an attempt to sort of lay out their points of view and to say this is what they were arguing about.
And talk to me about prophets and wizards, the terms.
Okay. Well, when I got what Borlaug's ideas were, this idea of, as I said, science and technology and making the human condition better with them. I have a friend who is a college roommate who went on to become a professor of philosophy. And so I called him up and I said, "Bob, what should I call this kind of thing?" And he said, "Oh, that's easy. It's pretty much a Schumpeterian technophiliac meliorist."
That would have been great as a title of a book. I would have bought it.
Yeah, right. You would have been alone.
I know, but
I said, "Okay, I don't think that's going to work. I'm going to call him a wizard." And I can't remember what the other one was, except that it was a processualist. Now, this is a pre-taped interview, right?
Yeah. So you finally came up with Wizards and Prophets. And actually, okay, that's a better title for a book, I fully admit. Now, my feeling is that the way a lot of things are happening now is somewhere in the middle. I think people are doing both, as a matter of fact. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, yes and no. Maybe they're doing one thing in one place and one thing in another. But when they try to do them both at the same time in the same place, they typically fight. I'll give you an example. There's a section in the book about water.
Yeah,
and,
okay.
Fresh water is actually probably the greatest short-run challenge that we have because there's just really amazingly little of it. That was a big shock for me to realize that the Earth's supply of fresh water is actually quite small.
Right, right.
And in a place like California where they have these droughts and they're running out of water, there's these two camps, and they call themselves the hard path and the soft path. They're the wizards and the prophets, wizards of the hard path. And they say, make more, put. And so there's these plans for these giant desalination facilities all along the coast, 20-plus of them, huge, huge things. And then also a thing that's been pushed forward by Governor Brown, it costs about $20 billion to make these giant tunnels to go under the Sacramento, you know, from the Sacramento River and funnel it down south, the kind of thing that you saw a little bit of in Chinatown, the movie. And there's tremendous environmental costs associated with this, and so the prophets are saying, wait, this is crazy. We're doing all this so that we can have golf courses in Palm Springs and swimming pools in Los Angeles and so forth. Why don't we just learn to live with the fact that...
Now, about water, though, it sounds like both camps are right. We could do with less watering of golf courses. Like, I just feel that's true, but we could also build desalination plants. So that's what I'm saying. Is there any sense of people talking to each other like in that way? Like, I'll do this and you do that?
You would think so.
But they're not!
And there's obviously no physical law that says that people can't do this. Can't meet in the middle. But very typically, you know, the kind of person that wants to build big desalination plants, the reason they want to do it is to have an unlimited supply of water so that they can have a huge amount of water so that people can do whatever they want with it. And they see the goal here is to maximize human well-being and human liberty and human freedom and so forth. And one of the things you could do is not have to worry about the water. And the other people see this is a kind of, not only is it sort of a aesthetic violation of the spirit of the place, but also that it's like wasteful and you should recognize where you're living. You're living in California. You're not living, right next to the lake.
It's a desert. It's a desert.
Right. And you should be part of it. You shouldn't try to pretend that you're not there. That way always leads to disaster.
Now, there's an even more interesting section of the book besides the biographies of these two people. And it's really, I think, the reason to buy this book is there's a meaty center. And I love the way how you put this in the center and not at the end. There's a meaty center of the book where you look at the four great oncoming challenges. What are those?
One of them is, food.
Basically. I want to talk about that in depth in just a second.
Food, feeding everybody.
Yeah.
Another one is one we just talked about, water. How are we going to have water for everybody? And then energy. How can we provide energy for everybody? And the fourth one's a little different. It's, what do we deal with? How do we deal with climate change?
Now, the first three seem very different from the fourth.
Yes, they are.
And almost climate change affects the previous three.
Mm-hmm.
So how does climate change relate to food, water, and energy, other than the sense that it will affect our food, our ability to get water, and our ability to get energy?
Well, there's two ways that it relates, and one is this, sort of the simple way. It's a huge challenge for the future. It's one of the biggest ones that I can think of, and so I wanted to list the four big ones.
Oh yeah.
The other is that it's a byproduct of satisfying two of the biggest challenges. One of which is energy, getting enough energy going, and the second is agriculture. And fossil fuels, and agriculture are the two big sources of greenhouse gases.
That's right.
So they're kind of a byproduct of satisfying the others. But you're absolutely right. It is different.
Let's talk about one of the specifics. And again, we're not even going to be able to cover all the information. The thing I appreciate about your book is the historical perspective that you give on not only the history of those two people, but each of these challenges, these four challenges. You really go in and give the entire history of how people have thought about this. That must have been a difficult thing to research.
It was, but it seems to me sometimes when you go back and you step back and say people have been thinking about this a lot, you approach it in a kind of a calmer way. It's easy to get freaked out when you think about the challenges that are lying ahead. And certainly, I'm sure you've talked to people about climate change who are very, very worried, or people who've talked about this or that are very, very worried. It's not so much that you shouldn't be worried and that they aren't big, big challenges, but once you realize that you're part of a whole chain of people who've been thinking about this, you don't feel quite so alone, I guess.
You mentioned that when you started realizing that in the year 2050, that the world is going to have 10 billion people in it, that you obviously start thinking about your children, you start thinking about your relatives, like how are we going to raise food output? And the figure you gave me, that brought me up short. 50 to 100%.
That's gonna have to go figure. And there's two reasons for that. One is there's more people. you know, we have 7.5 billion people now, and so it's going to go up to 10 billion, and that's, you know, so there's, you know, 25% more people. But the other thing that's even larger than that is that the world is getting more affluent. The difference between the world, you know, when I was born and when you were born and now is just phenomenal. You know, China is a much richer place. That's a fifth of the world. India, another fifth of the world, is a much richer place. Most of Asia, most of Latin America, and even Africa are vastly richer. And all those people are going to want the same things we want. You know, they're going to want air conditioning and, you know, nice clothes and cars and occasional treats. You know, they're going to want Toblerone. In fact, at one point I was going to call the book Toblerone for $10
billion. All these other titles, I think they would have been great. And you mentioned there's a lot of things that can affect this too, like suppose meat consumption upticks.
Yes.
That's going to have to increase the rise of food output too.
Yes, a lot. And one of the reasons that it's all so uncertain is that really nobody knows how much meat are people going to eat. And the reason that's so important is that it takes a lot of grain to produce
a
pound of meat. And there's lots of arguments about exactly how much. But the point is that if everybody's in India and China, who are now eating just very small amounts of meat, start eating the same amount of meat as us or, you know, somebody in Germany, you know, we're going to have to grow much, much, much more grain than if all of them suddenly, you know, adopted vegetarian diets. And so that's a big if in the whole thing.
You mentioned that there's two, logically speaking, this is a quote from your book, there are two paths to increasing harvests. One is lift actual yields, and then two, increase potential yields. Really explain the difference between those two things.
Okay. One is, you know, right now, that if everything goes perfect, a farmer who plants an acre of grain and, you know, the weather's perfect and the grain grows properly and there's no weeds and so forth, they can make a certain amount of, they can grow a certain amount of wheat. And it's always less than the maximum what they actually produce. And so one way of increasing what we produce is to make it closer and closer to the maximum, and that's, you know, learning how to fertilize properly and getting the right amount of water in there and dealing with weeds and all, you know, all the kinds of things that lower that. The other is to raise the ceiling, and that is to breed new plants, new types of plants that can produce more, and so just, you know, that changes the ball game.
And there's so much research that you talk about, and that's what I get. And again, another thing that I appreciate in this book is you really have surveyed things that are going on. Some of them are sort of in the midst of being developed, and let's talk about a few of those. Talk to me about C4 photosynthesis.
Okay, well, this is something I found completely fascinating. You know, for the wizards, the answer for all this is that we need to have more productive plants, and the way to do that is through genetic modification, GMOs,
right,
genetically modified organisms. And by this, they typically don't mean what we have today. Right now, what will happen is a company like Monsanto will find a gene in a, you know, a bacterium in a waste pond in Louisiana, for example, and they'll transplant it into soy, and that gene will produce a protein that makes it possible for you to put on weed killer on the soy plants, and it won't kill the soy plants, it'll just kill the weeds around them. And that's called Roundup Ready, and that's a hugely important commercial product for this company, Monsanto. What these guys are talking about is something quite different. This is basically gluing in, you know, one gene. They want to really, in effect, create a new species. And there's a number of projects like this, and I pick out the C4 Rice Initiative because I think it's the furthest along and also is most fascinating to me. And regular photosynthesis is called C3, and you don't really have to know the reason for that. It's just a biological shorthand. And it's incredibly inefficient. It's sort of mind-bogglingly inefficient. There's like nothing you do in your daily life that's anywhere close to as inefficient, no matter how inefficient you actually are. It was kind of comforting to realize that photosynthesis was such a lame basket case. It sort of barely works. And the reason for it, there's a couple reasons for it, but one of the big ones is that there's an enzyme involved in photosynthesis, which is called Rubisco. It's got, actually got a chemical name that's a mile long, and this is a sort of a shorthand name that they made jokingly to make it sound like a breakfast cereal. So you have this Rubisco.
That was the first thing I thought of, so go ahead.
And it what it does in the chain of reactions that causes photosynthesis, which is what makes plant grow, is it grabs the carbon dioxide from the air. As you maybe I should have said this, that you photosynthesis is when you have sunlight and water and carbon dioxide, and the plant grabs the carbon dioxide and uses the energy from the sunlight and breaks up the water, and it combines all these things to produce carbohydrates, which then turn into sugars and proteins and stuff like that that the plants need to grow. And so an essential step is grabbing the carbon dioxide from the air, and that's what Rubisco does. So it's a very key part of the whole thing. But it's really, really slow, and it's incredibly inefficient. And about 40% of the time, it doesn't grab carbon dioxide. It makes a mistake, and it grabs oxygen. And so the plant then can't use the oxygen and has this whole mechanism to get rid of the oxygen, reprime the Rubisco, and so forth. And as much as 50% of the energy that's involved in photosynthesis is wasted by this. And so what there's a type of plants that are called C4 that have developed a workaround around this, where the photosynthesis takes place in these special cells inside the leaf.
Now, these plants already exist.
Many of them exist. And you can actually see them in your thing. I don't know if you've ever mowed a lawn.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. One of the things you notice is that the crabgrass grows up immediately, and the regular grass doesn't. And crabgrass is C4 photosynthesis, and regular grass is C3. And, 3 days later, the crabgrass is tall again. And that's because it's not wasting all of its time grabbing oxygen that it can't use. Instead, it has a photosynthesis that takes place in these special cells that don't have any oxygen in them, or very little. And this mechanism of getting around this weakness of Rubisco has independently evolved like 60 times, maybe even 80 times. Biologists sort of argue about this. And the fascinating thing is what this is saying to biologists is it must be pretty easy for regular plants to become C4 plants because it happens so much. There's probably dormant genes in there that you can just wake them up, and the plant will do this. And there's some evidence that this is true, and that's what they're trying to do with rice, is to turn it into a C4 species. They'll grow much, much faster and produce much more rice, all in the same amount of area. And so this is changing, dozens or even hundreds of genes. It's a really ambitious thing, and it's genetically engineering the rice, ideally with its own genes.
You're
kind of an amazing thought.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is journalist, writer, correspondent Charles C. Mann, and we're talking about his latest book, The Wizard and the Prophet, two remarkable scientists and their dueling visions to shape tomorrow's world. Well, this brings up the whole thing of the controversy about GMOs.
Mm-hmm.
And from the prophet side of things, people are saying like, it'll alter our genes or something. Like, I do not believe that'll happen. I know it doesn't happen. I know it because I eat GMO food myself. What seems to be a more general concern is what effect these plants will have on the ecology of the area. People talk about things like these vast monoculture fields and the effects that they have on bees and pollinators, which is important to the ecosystems of the planet.
Right.
How do you answer that?
Well, no, I think yes. So there's sort of two layers of objection to GMOs. And one is, they're not safe, they're not safe. And
no, really they're safe.
Really just isn't much evidence for that.
Yeah.
And in fact, none that mm-hmm. I know of, that there's something unsafe. But a much more important and I think fundamental objection is that GMOs are described as a way to keep modern agriculture going, to keep this system that we have, but produce more. But if you don't like the system we have, that's like, not what you want to do. It's taking you in a place, even further in a place you don't want to go. And people don't like industrial agriculture because they think it's terrible for communities. It depopulates communities, and that's part of the reason we have so much social trouble in the Middle West. They think that it's kind of dangerous to be growing huge areas of a single type of plant, that's not an ecosystem, and it causes massive environmental damage, both from in terms of erosion, deforestation, the loss of fertilizer, which causes these big dead areas in waters. So they're saying, wait a minute, what you're doing with this elaborate technological mechanism is to go even further in a direction that we shouldn't be going in the first place.
Right, right.
And that, I think, is something worthy of arguing about.
One of the most fascinating for me in this section, and I sort of wanted to try some, there were these experiments with grasses, with wheatgrass.
Mm-hmm.
That looked really interesting.
Yes, it is.
Talk to me about that. That looked really fascinating.
So, you know, one of the typical responses back from the people, the wizards who are advocating the GMOs is, well, okay, I get that you don't like it, but, you know, what have you got? We got to provide all this more food. We can't just let people starve. And that's a good response, I think. And the prophets say, well, we have our own ideas. We can do things better. And one of them is that we could have perennial wheat. And one of the reasons that wheat agriculture, you know, causes erosion and so forth and doesn't and depletes the soil is that, you know, it grows in a year and then you harvest it and then, you know, the rain beats down and washes out the soil and the roots are very shallow, whereas perennial plants, you know, have big deep roots and they you know, create these soil ecosystems around the roots of all these different kinds of microorganisms, and they're much better for the soil. And that's, and there are sort of relatives of wheat that are perennial. And they're called typically things like wheatgrass, you know, intermediate wheatgrass. They have these very inspiring names. And, and so the idea is, could you take one of these things, which are used now for forage, and turn them into an annual crop, or a crop that you could harvest every year? And so various outfits like the Land Institute and some of the land-grant colleges have been doing this, and there's other efforts to hybridize them. So you have that, you know, something where you can mix wheat and wheatgrass, and so it have produced like wheat, but be a perennial like wheatgrass. And I think these are completely fascinating. They've been going on for a while because it's, you know, really difficult to work.
Yeah. It's time consuming.
There is actually now a product you can go to some restaurants, particularly in California, of course, and have what they call kernza, which is a, you know, wheatgrass flour. I've had it; it's pretty good.
And what can you do with it? Can you bake with it?
Yeah, you can do pretty much everything. I think that a real chef, not like me, would say that it's different than wheat, and you have to learn how to cook with it and so forth. But the stuff that I had in California, I had just quite recently, I thought was pretty tasty.
Wow.
You know, that's just one person, though.
Again, we're not going to cover, I just want to warn the audience, we're not covering but a tiny little fraction of everything that's in this book. In the global climate change section, there's a section, again, there's so many interesting ideas that you cover in this book, but I just had to talk about the strange forests. I was really captivated by that.
Well, that's the idea you know, what to deal with climate change. You know, everybody knows what the sort of basic thing that you have to do is, which is to release many fewer greenhouse gases.
Right.
You know, and the fundamental way that we produce them is through burning fossil fuels, through oil and natural gas and so forth. So we have to switch in some way to low carbon energy or zero carbon energy. Everybody knows this. But it's not clear what's the best way to do it and whether we can do it in time. And so if we can't do it in time, then very bad things could happen from climate change. What do you do in that case? And, you know, when we haven't been able to, you know, do things fast enough. And if we're unlucky, and it turns out the planet is very responsive to the amount of carbon dioxide in the air. And the wizards and prophets, again, have different ideas. And the wizards talk about geoengineering.
Right.
And here I should give a shout-out to a guy named Oliver Morton, a journalist who wrote a book called The Planet Remade, which is a really good book on this subject, if it happens to catch any of your readers' interest. It's a fascinating and wonderful book. Anyway, what that involves, well, there's a bunch of different ways, but the one that's most commonly talked about is taking some kind of tiny reflective sphere, like a little teeny droplet, glittering droplet of dilute sulfuric acid or water, and spraying it up in the stratosphere to bounce back some of the sun's light. And not enough to that you would notice it, but enough, because your eyes would adjust and so forth, but enough that it would reduce the amount of energy coming into the Earth system and cut down temperatures by a couple of degrees and sort of buy us more time to make this transition. The way that people talk about it is to getting a bunch of planes and spraying dilute sulfuric acid up there.
And I'm familiar with this idea, but I have to say, when you're working on projects this large, the chances for unintended consequences are huge.
Oh, yes. I'm not, by the way, the point here, I'm not trying to advocate.
And again, I want to emphasize that, too. You present all the ideas, and you're not advocating. You're just presenting the different ideas that people have.
I'm just trying to explain what's going on. Yeah.
But that sounds like these huge projects, and I understand the ideas, and I think we should be working on them just so that we have some kind of backup. But, man, does that sound like something could really go wrong that we hadn't
been? In fact, the people who advocate it, are very much in your camp. There's a joke that one of them told me that was that this is a bad idea whose time has come.
But and, getting back to the strange forest, there are people who are actually trying to...
Prophets have a different way. They say, okay, we get it. You know, we haven't been able to transition, so we need to draw some carbon dioxide out of here. One of the problems with geoengineering is it doesn't get rid of any of the carbon dioxide. It just, you know, reflects some sunlight. The carbon dioxide is still there. So if you stopped geoengineering, something would just get much hotter very fast. So they say, what we need to do is actually draw it out of the air, and there are these natural carbon-eating mechanisms. You've seen them all the time. They're called trees.
Amazing.
And so why don't we involve ourselves in some really massive reforestation? And they look at the Sahara, where there's not a tree for, you know, thousands and thousands of miles. Not too long ago, geologically speaking, you know, a few thousand years ago, it was all covered by forest. We could do that again. You would have some small desalination plants around the edges, and you would plant these drought-resistant trees. Jatropha is one of the ones that they talk about. Eucalyptus as well, although I don't think it's as suitable. And you could, you know, slowly reforest the Sahara. And, you know, the trees themselves would change the climate around them, and they would also shed branches and leaves, and you could use that eventually to feed the desalination. And there's proof positive that this could actually work, in that the southern border of the Sahara is called the Sahel.
Yeah.
And in the 1980s, there was a big wave of deforestation, and tens of thousands of people starved to death. It was awful.
Oh,
it was a terrible, terrible human crisis. And what happened there is people, using very simple means over the last 30 or 40 years, have reforested giant swaths of the Sahel. And now it's a much nicer place than it was 30 or 40 years ago, and it's drawing a lot of carbon out of the air. And so they're saying, why not do this? And we should, you know, as the people who put, you know, us Americans and, you know, Europeans as the people who put most of the carbon in the air, we should fund this.
It sounds great. And it sounds like there's less possibilities for an unintended consequence, and it's almost like, what would the harm be? Like, yeah. You'd have
to. You know, I mean, I think I could make up some if you wanted.
We're almost out of time, Charles. And the problem with this book, and it's not a problem, the challenge of this book, let me put it that way, is that there are so many ideas and so many topics that you could literally pick any one chapter and talk for hours about it.
Oh, thank you.
One of the things I'd love to see you do is revisit this book in 10 years.
That's interesting. My hope was that this book would still be good in 10 years, and because it's laying out sort of the fundamental ideas that you would...
But wouldn't some of the ideas be further along then?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things, for example, in climate change that's really not very clear yet is exactly... how fast it's moving. There's a lot of argument about that.
Yeah.
And maybe 10 years from now we'll have more data. Another thing that's really unclear is the price of things like solar panels is going down, 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 down. And there's some suggestion that the price of things like batteries is also going down, 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 down. And if we could couple that with energy transmission, suddenly renewable energy would become much more possible and doable. We'll know more about that in 10 years.
It will be a lot more attractive.
Yeah. I mean, if it's cheap, already in some special places, renewable, you know, solar power is cheaper than any of the alternatives.
Oh, man.
But would it be amazing if that was true in more places, you know, the Middle West or even up here?
I knew we would hardly talk about anything in this book. It was like, and that's a testament to the book, by the way, Charles. And thank you so much for writing this. My guest tonight has been journalist, writer, correspondent Charles C. Mann. And we've been talking about his new book. It's big, and it's big for a purpose. There's a lot in there. The Wizard and the Prophet, two remarkable scientists and their dueling visions to shape tomorrow's world. Charles, it's been a real pleasure. I hope you come back.
Oh, please, give me a call again.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.